the studios of KPCW in Park City. This is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning Katie Mullally and I speak with author Mark Weinstein about restoring our sanity online in the world of the internet and how to deal with the internet's bots and trolls. There are some very special tips that he gives, so stay tuned for that. And then I speak with BBC's zoological correspondent Jules Howard about the simple egg, how it has evolved, adapted, and innovated over time. It's a metaphor, really, for the evolution of the planet and the evolution of the human. That all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Most of us know that social media platforms and the internet are crawling with bots and trolls. Yet even the most social media savvy users fall victim to the bait, engaging with misinformation, commenting on inflammatory posts, and more. And now, add on to that, AI bots and trolls. Well, do we even stand a chance? How can we identify and even get rid of these pests? And what does this all mean for our online privacy? And is there really such a thing? Joining us to talk about how we got here and what we can do to maybe get back to the original intention of the web, which was to do good and share, is privacy expert, social networking visionary, and tech entrepreneur Mark Weinstein. He is also the author of the new book, Restoring Our Sanity Online, A Revolutionary Social Framework. Mark, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Great to be here.
We started out with talking about bots and trolls on social media, and I think we get stuck in just thinking that these bots and trolls are just with social media, but the web permeates our lives, which means these bots permeate our lives, right? I mean, is the web everywhere? Is there anything we can do that's not associated with the web?
Well, those are important and large questions. Let's clarify, you know, a bot or a troll is not there when you're doing your banking or, you know, when you're using PayPal, when you're doing a transaction on Amazon. That's not the home of bots and trolls. The real epicenter of bots and trolls is really in social media. And they are there purposefully to trick you, to bait you, to inflame you, and to disrupt our democracy. So it's really a massive problem. And every web company deals with it. You know, how do we do this? Now, you're right, because the original intention, not just of the web, and for our listeners, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the actual inventor of the web, and Tim didn't invent the web so that we could be targeted, manipulated, and so that our children could have their mental health challenged and our democracy eroded. Tim invented the web, really, you know, it was a scientific thing at first for communication among scientists, but it's all about authentically communicating. And when social media came around, at first we called them community portals, and it was really very similar. The idea of social media is really, the origination of it was so that we could stay connected using great technology. Now, think of this, it was the 90s. Email was already ghastly. You know, email is one-dimensional. You know, you can't really get a read on who you're communicating with, what they're really thinking. We misinterpret it all the time. The same problems existed in the 90s. The point is that there was already great technology that you could use online. Social media was born out of the need to take advantage of these great communication tools, the web, with photos and videos and all kinds of great communication with groups of people, way beyond, at the time, you know, a text thread. And keep us connected around the world with our families and our friends, because we could travel anywhere, we could work anywhere. That was already part of life. There's this amazing foundation.
Okay, that's quite a foundation. Thank you, Mark. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Mark Weinstein. He's a social networking visionary and tech entrepreneur. On the one hand, Mark, I want to say to you, shame on you for helping create social media. On the other hand, of course, as you say, it connects us to friends and family. However, someone like me, I've become so disenfranchised with social media that my beautiful, wonderful son got married in July, and I haven't even posted a thing about that. I haven't changed my profile picture to that beautiful family photo at the wedding because I just don't want to have anything to do with it anymore, which is sad. It's sad, but are you finding that people are becoming adept at all so that they can separate out the trolls and the bots from the simple family connections? And this is where you'll probably talk a bit about privacy.
Well, Lynn, first I'm going to just comment on what you said, and that's not sad at all. So I want you to stop being sad right away about the fact that you are disconnecting yourself from this paradigm called social media. You have text threads, which are very effective. You can text pictures that you want to the people, exact people that you want. You could turn off the metadata on those pictures if you don't want location, data shared, and other information, because it's important for our listeners to know that every time you take a picture with your phone, there's something called metadata. You never see it, but it is there. And when you share a photo, when you post it online, or you even share it in a text thread, the metadata is imprinted in that photo and can be uncovered. And it includes the location, you know, where you are, the time, it's stamped. It's basically a time and location stamp. Now, very easy to turn off. So the first thing I want to inform our listeners about is, if you really want privacy, then turn off the metadata on all your photos moving forward. And then you can also go back into a photo, open it up, and then you can find the controls to erase the metadata. And then moving forward, you could just turn the metadata off because we don't really need that stuff. But it's default on your iPhone and your Android phone. But it's very easy. Go to your settings. Go to your camera or, you know, you'll see, go to location. It'll be in one of those, or go to security. It's going to be in one of those three places. And then just scroll down and find, you know, if you're going to security settings on an iPhone, then just scroll down, find your camera, then find, you know, find the metadata, find the location, turn it off. Very easy. At the same time, you don't need to change your profile picture. The fact is that we've all gotten so adept at texting and group texting. And, you know, you can do it either just on your phone's systems or you can do it through a Telegram or a Signal. It's important for our listeners to note that while you all may love WhatsApp and use it, WhatsApp is a Facebook product. So you just want to be cognizant of this. There's a huge thing in the world called the data ecosystem. And this is just the massive bucket of all the data that's collected and sorted and, you know, AI analyzed and psychologically analyzed, and then you're targeted and manipulated. And Facebook collects data from your WhatsApp. And so what happens is your location, who you're talking to, all this stuff. The only thing they don't get to is the actual conversation itself, but they get everything else. Now, in the old days of WhatsApp, you know, they weren't even looking at anything. There was no collection of data, but Facebook paid billions to buy WhatsApp to collect data. So I highly recommend that you move your groups to a Signal or a Telegram as opposed to a WhatsApp. But again, I want to, you know, for all of you, if you find yourself, you know, disenfranchised or disgusted, let's use a different D word, disgusted with the current state of affairs of the social media in particular, where you're sharing, remember, it doesn't matter how good you are with your privacy controls on a Facebook or, you know, Meta's products, Instagram, they're still getting all your data. And then that is still going straight into, you know, and they're still analyzing everything that you say and doing a massive psychological analysis of exactly how to manipulate your brain, your thoughts, your purchase decisions. And if you're a teenager and if you're a teenage female, then what they're doing is ghastly because they are totally focused on your body image, on how you feel about yourself and your friends. And they are absolutely just targeting you with products that are suggesting that maybe you have a problem when you don't, but then you start to think that you do. And they're sending these articles and information to you you didn't ask for. So we've got to be super careful.
Well, Mark, before we get into the really thought-provoking solutions you propose in your book, I started reading the section about AI bots, and bots and trolls are bad enough. But when we throw in an AI bot, tell our listeners really what next level nefarious behavior AI bots can bring.
You know, it's, I'm sorry, but some of this is so absurd, it's hilarious. You know, it's hilarious in the absurdity of it. First of all, I want to go beyond social media to the little stuffed animals now that have AI built into them for children. So, you know, you can give your kid a little teddy bear that's got an AI bot. That's, you connect the teddy bear to the web so that the AI bot can connect to the intelligence that it needs to be speaking to your kid or to you. And this is really out of hand, because what's that AI bot doing? Whether it's your AI, you know, friend on Snap, or whether it's a little teddy for your little kid, that AI bot is collecting data. So imagine that for a little kid, there it is. It's already starting to collect data. So all that data now is going into the data ecosystem. You know, even if they claim they don't sell it to third parties, it always gets out and always gets into the bigger system. Information about that kid starts, that bucket starts right there. But on Snap and, you know, Facebook, all these places that are now adding this AI friend, that AI bot is just a data collector. But here's the magnificent absurdity. That AI chatbot can actually manipulate your thoughts and then really get in deep with you and learn all about you and put that, your emotions, your thoughts, you know, what you really want, what you're thinking, you know, because they're your friend. They become, there's this intimate relationship that humans, because humans are easily persuaded by an AI friend. There's actually something cozy about it, something intimate and friendly about it. And the revelation, you reveal yourself because you know, you think you've got this perfect friend. Unbelievably absurd.
And there are people who want to deregulate further technology platforms. Wow, that's crazy. I had not heard of that one. I wanted to ask you, Mark, about, since very deep into campaign season, I don't typically read comments, but there were these two posts that I was looking at. One was sort of pro one candidate. We're talking presidential candidate. So one was pro one candidate. One was pro the other. And underneath in the comments, I started reading, and 100% of the comments were anti, you know, we're against this pro, you know, let's say pro Harris thing. So there were all these reasons. But as I was reading them, I thought, this is really strange that 100% of these comments are against Harris. And when you read through them, they started to have these very similar themes. And while they seemed legitimate, if you just read the first three, once you started reading them, it was obvious that these were AI bots. And then the same, you know, there was one with Trump, and it was doing the same thing in, you know, kind of the other direction. And I thought, how strange this is. How does that happen? And how can we be more wary about it? Because it could really influence a reader. It's like, wow, all these people are anti-Trump, anti-Harris. Maybe I should be too.
First of all, for our listeners, this is a massive question. This is really the question of the day, because it leads to a much bigger conversation. That conversation starts with, we Americans don't really hate each other. We've been made to hate each other by bots and trolls that are funded by nefarious operatives in adversarial countries. And this is well documented. So the Russians, the Chinese, they have massive, I mean, tens of thousands of human beings running their bot and troll farms. This is well documented. These are deeply funded by their own, quote, deep states. And so very simply, we are being utterly manipulated to hate each other, to dislike and distrust everything that we read, to distrust our candidates. And so, and it's actually, Lynn, that's really easy to do, because there are millions of bots, I'm sorry, because we know data. Listen, here's another really crazy stat that's, by the way, I do talk facts. So you can check anything that I say with legitimate sources online. Just Google what I, you know, test. Or, you know, if you, you know, use DuckDuckGo, which is a better privacy search engine. But Elon Musk and President Biden, both of them, it's well documented that over 50% of their followers on X are bots. So, you know, that's just how it rolls. So when you start to look at this, and then you look at a presidential candidate that makes a post somewhere, and then you look at the thread. Well, those bot and troll farms are utterly ready. They're ready to go. And by the way, if they're verified, if it happens to be on X, any bot and troll could get verified because they all know, you know, they're all programmed. First of all, some are actually real people, just operatives, but they're also their AI programmed, but they also have their credit cards programmed in. They have all the, they can pay. Anybody can pay for the blue check. So, and that was the complete fallacy in Musk's rolling out this sort of blue check verified. Verified means that you paid me, and so now you get to boost your posts anywhere you want. That's still a field day for the bots and trolls. And the bots and trolls are just disrupting everything. And then you add into that, and I apologize to all of you who may like or love TikTok, but it is well documented that TikTok has deep connections to the Chinese government, that TikTok not only puts out a huge amount of propaganda and also blocks information that they don't want revealed about China, but the TikTok also purposefully manipulates our young people with all kinds of streams in their content that is disgusting, dissuades them from the ideas of STEM and encourages them all to be, you know, social media stars. And here's the catch. The catch is in China, the same app, there's a different name, same app, you know, same company. Kids are only allowed to, literally limited to 40 minutes a day, and the content is completely different. Wow. Sure, there's some fun music and things like that, some fun things, but there is a ton of, you know, science, technology, engineering, math, post. There's a ton of interesting stuff. It's educational and encourages the kids to be great citizens and be engineers and all these other things. The Chinese young people don't want to be social media stars. That's not how the app is oriented.
Wow. Well, good for them. Not good for the Chinese government, but good for the Chinese kids. Well, Mark, the tagline of your book is a revolutionary social framework. So let's talk about you're calling it the restoration network. I mean, there can be hope for this problem that we face. Tell us about the restoration network.
Hope is here. And I always say that hope requires action, just like prayer requires action. So it's time for us to feel empowered again. And Lynn, I'm talking to you. Time for us to feel empowered again, because, you know, I had a question in an interview the other day. The interviewer asked, well, isn't it all over? My data's already out there. Should we just give up? And it was a great question. The answer is no, because we can stop it right now. The future of social media includes like this stopping data collection. So maybe your data, there's already so much of it out there, but you can stop the data collection today. You can stop the data collection on your kids today. You can stop the data collection on future generations. You can stop the manipulation of our minds, all of this stuff. And so the future restoration, let me explain this to our listeners. Big agriculture, big energy, and big tech have some very surprisingly common threads. Essentially, they start with this altruistic, these visions of serving humanity. Big energy, great. I mean, look, we could get electricity. We can get oil. We can get these things. And then we can, you know, sort of equalize it. It's big ag. We need to feed the community. We can do it better than everybody just having a plot, and we can keep ourselves fed. Let's figure out how to start, you know, with a community farm and things like that. They start with these great visions. They turn into massive monopolistic companies that have no ethics or are only interested in their bottom line dollars. That's what happened when Mark Zuckerberg in 2010 said to the world at the Crunchy Awards in an interview, he said, privacy is a social norm in the past, because at this point, Facebook was emerging as this massive monopoly and privacy was no longer a criteria for anything except that would limit his wallet, his pocketbook. So he threw privacy for the world out. I was jaw dropped. I was like stunned. I saw the interview. I was like, oh my God, I got to come back and try and fix this, which I did. So the answer is, so now it's time. Then there are the movements in big ag and big energy. You know, renewable energy, it didn't start with the big oil companies. It starts with the big utility companies. It starts with visionary entrepreneurs. So it's the same thing with the organic movement and things like that. It doesn't start with the big companies. It starts with the entrepreneurs who want to go back, who want to restore. So it's time. And this is not hard to do. The government is already helping. The case, the antitrust case against Google recently, where the government ruled against Google, and now we're going to see some real movement. The government is going to make some decisions. Google has to stop boxing in the search market, but they totally dominate and box everybody out. There's an antitrust case against Facebook. That will come to resolution. I've testified in that case. So that will come to resolution because we've got to get the free market working. So this is the key. We've got to turn the free market on. The government is actually helping. This is critical because capitalism works when monopolies don't dominate it and kill the free market, because the free market serves people. That's how it works. You're an entrepreneur, you figure out a way to serve people, you jump in.
Well, Mark, in your book, Restoring Our Sanity Online, if we're talking about creating a market, I wanted to ask you about DuckDuckGo, because we've spoken to Gabriel Weinberg,
yeah.
Yeah. We've spoken to him on this show before, and I feel like it was when DuckDuckGo was in its infancy, and I thought, wow, this is going to take off hugely. But I would say that if you mentioned, you know, outside of your tech world, but if you just mentioned to the average person on the street, DuckDuckGo, maybe about half of them, if that, has ever even heard of it. And yet, as you say, this is a platform we should all be using. I only use it sometimes. It should be my default browser, right? Can you talk a little bit about that and why we don't? Is it because really, truly Google is a monopoly?
Yes, it's called the network effect. So this is a term, network effect. And it works on Facebook because, you know, once the whole world is on Facebook, which half of the world is, just about, you know, 3 billion people, it becomes much harder to enter. And then especially when those companies get so big, what Facebook and Google do is they box out. They make contracts. They lock in contracts with companies like Apple and other companies to use their search engines. Now, I've watched DuckDuckGo since the beginning. This is the same issue that I had with MeWe, which is the network effect. You know, MeWe was a social network engineered to compete with Facebook, but with no boosted posts, timeline-ordered news feeds, a privacy bill of rights, careful terms and conditions so, you know, that trust and safety could moderate. But, you know, there was no biased moderation, et cetera. But the network effect can't work when other companies not only lock it up, they lock up all the sort of access points, all your friends are going to be over there, but then they inhibit your success. Now, this is why the antitrust case against Google, the courts ruled against Google, because it's so heavily documented how they completely boxed out, acquired, and destroyed almost every competitor except for Gabriel. And Gabriel now claims to have about 100 million users worldwide. But I doubt I would say it's probably 5% of people you would ask would have ever heard of DuckDuckGo, not 50. I think you're being generous there. The same thing with Facebook. Facebook either acquired or destroyed virtually every competitor. And the Federal Trade Commission says the only two that were left was Snap and MeWe. No one's ever heard, but still, people on the street, of course, kids have heard of Snap because Snap was built on disappearing content before they built out the platform to compete with Facebook. And it still really doesn't, but it's personal social media, which is a distinction from just regular social media like a Twitter or TikTok, where you're not really concerned about your friends there, you're just watching.
And that was privacy expert, social networking visionary and tech entrepreneur Mark Weinstein. His new book, Restoring Our Sanity Online, A Revolutionary Social Framework. There's about 6 minutes more to that conversation that you can hear online. Go to kpcw.org and under the shows tab or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Well, the evolution of the egg, how it has evolved, adapted, and innovated over time is the dramatic subplot missing, according to our next guest, in many accounts of how life on Earth came to be. Our guest is science writer Jules Howard, and he'll talk about whether the egg belongs to birds, insects, mammals, or millipedes. Eggs are objects shaped by their ecology, forged by mass extinctions, and honed by natural selection to near perfection. Jules Howard is a zoological correspondent who appears regularly on BBC Radio 4 on shows including Nature Table, Inside Science, and The Ultimate Choice. And he joins me today to talk about the new book, The Infinite Life, The Story of Eggs, Evolution, and Life on Earth. Oh, it's a loving ode to eggs. Who would have thought? Jules Howard, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thanks for that lovely introduction, Lynn. What a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you and to find out what led you down this path to say, hey, I am driven to write a book about eggs.
So it's a good question. The answer's slightly off-piste. It's a bit weird, but bear with me. So I've always had a big interest in animal reproduction and also animal kind of lifespans and longevity and life history and how sort of evolution sort of, well, animals get shaped, if you like, in loads of different weird and wonderful ways. So I always had in the back of my mind, I wonder if there's a different way of telling the traditional animal evolution story, you know, that we, you know, receive from fossils and from a lot of the science in this area of, you know, the traditional story being fish evolved, you know, walked out, you know, upon the beaches and evolved into land animals. And from that, we had amphibians and reptiles, dinosaurs, etc., and mammals. And I really wanted to tell that kind of evolutionary story in a different way. So eggs became a sort of camera, if you like, a sort of perspective through which we could re-explore the evolution of the animal kingdom. But the idea itself, I said it was a bit weird. The idea itself came from, I was working on a project a few years ago where I created a 3D model of a duck's vagina, essentially, its reproductive anatomy, working with another scientist called Patricia Brennan. And we made this like a sort of tour, virtual reality tour that members of the public could take to learn about the incredible adaptiveness of this organ that most of us would never normally get to see. And it was doing that, it was kind of traveling around in this inside this duck's anatomy, that I was kind of like, wow, I wonder if we could ever tell a story about animals and evolution, you know, from this kind of inside perspective. Because, you know, eggs, although we think of birds' eggs, actually eggs are very much manufactured in animal bodies, and the story of kind of how they're shaped and how they get out even, I just hadn't read about that before. So I was like, that's creative, I want to try it. And it's been a joy, really, to sort of release it into the world like an egg.
Yeah, exactly. And so thus is born The Infinite Life. So let's talk about that then. I mean, I don't want to focus for the whole interview on a duck's vagina, but one of the first questions that came up for me is, you know, have we evolved to either stop producing eggs inside and deliver live babies, or, you know, what has that evolution been, or have we evolved away from producing live young and have started to grow eggs?
It's amazing. And like, bear in mind, you know, I've been writing about zoology for, you know, 20 years, and I got into this frame of thinking that somehow mammal evolution, you know, the fact that we give birth to live babies and we don't have an obvious egg that we can see, I sort of got into the frame of mind of thinking that was, oh, wow, it was meant to be, you know, we're the exalted animals, you know, that do it. Clearly, this is the best way. But actually, when you look throughout the sort of animal tree of life, you see internal eggs, you see them all over the place. So, you know, in bony animals, it's evolved something like 150 times independently, separately, you know, in different parts of the animal family tree. So it's by no means unique to just our little mammal branch. And we see it often in sharks. In fact, sharks give us some really good ideas for why why it tends to occur. And in sharks, it's often partly to do with the environment. So the colder the outside temperature, the less likely it is that eggs will survive on their own. So it becomes kind of advantageous to have those eggs within the body where mm-hmm. they can be kept at a warmer temperature. And obviously eggs, particularly in the early stages, are kind of full of enzymes, and enzymes work much better in warmer temperatures, or most of them do. And so that sort of facilitates the growth of the embryo. So probably in our history, in mammal evolutionary history, but also in many of the other animals that have gone down this line, it's probably to do with the environment. In mammals especially, if you imagine the dinosaurs and the fact they're dominating the world 150 million years ago, mammals, we think, you know, became kind of creatures of the night, and the night was our realm. That was when we could be most active and busy. Of course, nights are very cold, so looking after eggs is that bit more difficult. So in some ways, the fact that we give birth and we don't lay gorgeous eggs is because we are creatures of the night, you know, that lived literally in the shadows of dinosaurs. So that's what I love. I love about animals is that, you know, many of the things that we take for granted are have been shaped and chiseled, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago.
Right, right. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with science writer Jules Howard. He's written a new book called The Infinite Life. It's the stories of eggs, evolution, and life on Earth. It's really interesting that the titles of each of your chapters in the book include these periods of time that some of which I've never even heard of. So let's go back to what you found and how you found the very first egg. When and how?
Yeah, so the very first eggs, as far as that, like what we can see, so the evidence, the actual fossil evidence, is about 600 million years ago. So some of your listeners might have heard of the Cambrian explosion. This is about 500 million years ago, when many of the early representatives of things like mollusks and fish and crustaceans, that's when they sort of start to evolve, when they start to appear. We're talking about a world 100 million years before that. So it's basically a world of like jellyfish kind of animals. Very strange, bag-shaped, floating, swimming organisms. And the fossils of their eggs are, I mean, for years it's been argued about whether they're even eggs at all, but these are very, very small spherical structures that turn up in a part of China called the Jishanto Formation. And essentially these fossils, incredible to study, they take a real eye, but they're like grains of sand. They're about as wide as a human hair. Diameter of a human hair. And what's so cool about these fossils is you can see a lot of them are sort of split open, and the process of fossilization involves a lot of phosphorus in these rocks. And phosphorus is capable of showing the signs of cells, literally fossilized cells. And you can see within these eggs, two cells, some of them have four cells, some of them have eight cells. So you see, you know, the process of what was cell division taking place in these lost eggs. Now, what were they from? We don't really know. I mean, some scientists argue that they're from very early worm-like organisms, 600 million years ago. Some argue that they're probably from jellyfish-like organisms. So we can say with some confidence, you know, these were eggs. We're still not sure quite what kinds of animals were around back then to lay them. And so that's the evidence. But actually, when you look at DNA, so if you look across all of the animals alive today, we all use the same bit of DNA code to make sperm. And if all animals have the same bit of DNA coding to make sperm, that suggests they've inherited it from a common ancestor. So the common ancestor of all animals alive today was, we think, about 1,000 million years ago. So essentially, fossil eggs, 600 million years ago, the capacity to make eggs and sperm perhaps 1,000 million years ago. So this is a really ancient way of reproducing on this planet. It's clearly very advantageous for animals to use eggs in their sort of genetic transfer, because so many animals are completely embedded in doing this, you know, in the modern day. So it's a really, we don't think about it often. I don't know about you, but I used to think of just like chicken's eggs, you know, what is an egg? Oh, it's just chicken's egg.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, actually, this is a structure that animals are kind of kind of in an evolutionary way addicted to. They can't find a better way of you know, sending genes forward times than the egg. Yeah.
Wow, so interesting. Well, let's talk about that, because yes, I like you and many of our listeners, I'm sure, are thinking of an egg that comes out with a hard shell. And there's a story in and of itself about what that egg does. But let's talk about that for a second. You know, we know that a hard shell is protective, but you talked about enzymes in the shell. What else does that shell, if there is one, do?
It's an absolutely excellent question. I mean, like you say, the protective element is very important. All eggs have natural compounds, molecules that are very good at destroying bacterial invaders or fungal invaders. This is why in the UK, at least, we don't wash our eggs. We tend to leave all of the juices on there because, of course, that will protect the egg. We don't wash our chickens' eggs, I should say. I'm not sure about other eggs. But anyway, yeah, so that's one thing. Also, protection against the sun. So, you know, the sun is clearly, you know, emitting loads of radiation. Radiation damages DNA. It's the last thing a developing embryo needs. So protection from the sun is another. But also a lot of, particularly insect eggs, they are really, really good at keeping water inside the egg. So one of the reasons, you know, the insects have become such a driving force on this planet, you know, it's basically a planet of insects. One of the reasons for that is their really incredible blanket, if you like, that's just under the eggshell called the serosa. And I argue in the book, this is one reason why insects have done so incredibly well as an animal group, is because their eggs are so hard wearing, they can be put all over the place, all over the place.
Yeah, that was a question I had about the egg that does not need a shell. You know, we think of eggs or larvae, I guess, as these things that oftentimes need a host or some place that those eggs can be deposited so that they can come to fruition, that they can come to maturation and create either an insect or whatever it is. Can you talk about those types of eggs or larvae? Yeah, getting into this whole world of eggs that we wouldn't have thought of. So the shell-less eggs.
One place I'm taken to very often, I suppose, is the world of, you know, the underwater world of the release of not just one or two or 10 or 20, but, you know, organisms that can release millions of eggs in one fell swoop, so to speak. So things like sea urchins, starfish, all sorts of strange sea snails, even things we now think like trilobites, these ancient creepy crawly like animals that lived in the sea. Absolutely amazing how they can invest so much energy in producing so many eggs. So on one side, when I think about eggs, yeah, I think about that. I think about these kind of misty storms, basically watery storms filled with eggs, often, you know, released, as we know, you know, in time with the moon and the you know, the warmer seasons, certain nights when coral reefs kind of come alive with all sorts of different eggs. But then, like, the converse side of that, where animals and humans and whales are examples of this, where animals, you know, they evolve the other way. They evolve to secure one giant egg, one giant embryo, and look after that and grow it as big as possible so that they can then, you know, better guarantee, I suppose, a surviving offspring. So that sort of relationship that you see along animals is really, really interesting. And I'd say that the converse to us, right? So the complete opposite to us is something like, do you know what a sunfish is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the sunfish it's about the size of, I'm just looking, like a kind of big dustbin lid, right? Big fish. And a large one of those can produce 2 million eggs at a time. And the babies, they are, so you're thinking about an animal that, you know, can grow much larger than a dustbin lid, that starts off about the size of the smallest full stop you've ever seen, like a size 2 font full stop. And that tiny, tiny fish larvae that can grow, you know, can grow to that sort of size. So I think it increases its size by 60,000 times.
Wow.
From the egg stage. It's like the equivalent of me, you know, growing into an adult form that's the size of Wembley Stadium. like incredible that you know that natural selection can trim and chisel and sort of change the life history dynamics of the egg, but also how many eggs, you know, are produced in a single kind of batch, I suppose. So yes, there's that was almost the big challenge of the book, being completely honest. That was a really big challenge of the book, is that how do you cover a life structure that, you know, millions of animals depend on in a satisfying way, I guess. So for me, doing it like a chronologically felt like the best way of telling the story, I guess.
Yeah, well, your book has already had some great critical review that talks about the enthusiasm and the interest and the fascination that it produces. Just, I mean, as you're talking now, I'm considering eggs in a way that I never have before. And, you know, as you were talking about these, you know, single cell eggs or these, you know, microscopic eggs, it always leads to the lore of some species of insect, which, you know, they say, oh, when they bite you, they're actually laying eggs under your skin. So tell us, is that a thing?
I'd say one of the, I mentioned about insects and about how their eggs are world conquering, you know, literally, mm-hmm. you know, conquering continents, a lot of them, and how, you know, what is considered advantageous to an insect is something we might deplore. So the example I'm using, you might have noticed I'm recording this in one of my children's bedrooms, right? So you
yes.
can see Harry
Potter.
I didn't
think that was your poster.
No. I felt like I had to get that in there somewhere just in case you were like, wow, this guy's got a really interesting, you know, room. She won't mind me telling you that we had a bit of a head louse incident about 6 months ago. And bear in mind, I'm a zoologist. I honestly thought I'll always know if they've got head lice because, you know, I take a deep interest in all sorts of creatures. And unbeknownst to me, yeah, she had head lice. She might have had them for a couple of years, to be honest. Never like, not crazy and not massively noticeable either. Her hair is hid it quite well. But essentially the nits, do you call them nits in the US?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the hard sort of egg cases, if you like, that head lice use to kind of keep their eggs in place. And in fact, this is, you know, I see you itching. I can see you itching. Here we go. This is basically any shell with any egg with a hard casing, whether it's a bird or a head louse. That hard casing is put on a bit like, you know, as the egg passes through the egg tube, it's a bit like a car wash, right? There's different nozzles for different things. And one of the nozzles you have in birds, you also have a similar one in insects. As the egg's coming out, it gets completely covered in a foam and that foam hardens. Now, in the case of head lice, that foam is like cement. It's incredibly tough once it hardens. And that obviously makes their egg, you know, really, really resilient. But there are many eggs like that that can be put in places where they can't be killed. So with wasps, for instance, parasitic wasps, of which there are probably 500,000 different species, very understudied group, most of them really, really small. But their eggs, again, are incredibly hard wearing, and many of those are squirted into other animals like caterpillars. So they have to be not just tough enough to physically survive in the body of another animal, but also strong and resilient enough so that the wasp's egg doesn't get killed by the caterpillar's immune system. So there, you know, I think there you see, I was going to say, there you see a different kind of beauty in eggs, but even I can't be that patronizing. But like, you know, this is it. This is a success story that insects especially have wielded their eggs in all sorts of unique and clever ways. We have a bit of an outbreak in parts of the UK of bed bugs.
Yes.
And that's another great example of, you know, bed bug eggs particularly travel quite well. They don't tend to dry out. They've also got a very hard casing as well. So again, that makes them incredibly tough to remove and really tough to control or eradicate. So that's the downside. The good side, I would say, is that eggs are also really, really adaptable. So the timing at which insect eggs hatch, you know, is clearly something that we can see changing with as the climate changes. We can see eggs of insects especially adapting quite quickly, and that obviously is a good thing if we're talking about good, you know, let's say friendly insects that keep pests at bay and can control kind of other species. So yeah, eggs themselves are like capable of kind of quick adaptation, quite a quick evolution. So this isn't the final form, if you like, that planet Earth's eggs will take. It's likely to change, you know, in the next 1,000 years or so. I'm sure of it.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, I'm wondering, since you brought up head lice and then, you know, and said that it possibly was on your daughter's scalp for a very long time, I have to ask that about that a bit further. How could she not have picked it up?
Yeah,
or,
I mean,
or felt it at, you know.
Yeah,
the, yeah,
yeah, yeah. I mean, it is part of the reason is that a little bit like with other biting insects, moving away from eggs slightly here, but with biting insects generally, you know, some people react with rashes or an immune response that's incredibly strong, and some people less so. So I think with her, it was, you know, there was no, it was like, if you like, there was no evidence, no itching or anything like that. But it was, you know, quickly taken care of, thankfully, that we have a various kind of sprays, like shampoo sprays, mm-hmm. and one guy with that, and it was all gone. But it was interesting. I mean, it was a bit embarrassing for me as a zoologist to sort of have that. But also it was really kind of interesting to sort of, I don't know, really just to sort of see this, you know, in our own house, if you like. I mean, you know, the other one in houses is and even in museum collections is clothes moths, you know, most moths,
right?
Hundreds of thousands of species of moth, you know, a tiny proportion of them, their caterpillars, their grubs will feed on hair, so mostly mammal pelts, dead, you know, dead mammals. And of course, when they get into our houses, they can make quite quick work of our soft furnishings, our clothes and our carpets. And in fact, with museum specimens that get infected with clothes moths, they have to have sort of sometimes up to 2 weeks treatment in a sub-zero temperatures. So 2 weeks at minus 20 or so degrees is what is needed to destroy their eggs.
Hmm.
So incredibly tough structures. There is nothing really else like them in the story of animals. But, you know, their resilience is also their triumph, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, sorry to get off on this tangent about these things that affect our daily lives, but really that is how we apply the lessons learned in your book to our daily lives. But let me ask you about moths further, because we have had an incredible hatch of moths this summer. It's been, of course, a very hot summer. We're in the mountains. Park City's comes in at about 6,800 feet of elevation. So high mountains, a moth hatch like nothing I have ever seen before. And I don't love it, I have to say.
What sort of species? I mean, like, what do they do? What's their, are they ones that make tents and sort of gather in big silky webs, or are they?
No, they're just, you know, they're just under everything. You pull up a pillow and there's a moth under your pillow, or you know, they're just everywhere.
Well, this is we've kind of got the opposite thing over here in the UK this year. We've had an incredibly cold, wet summer. And in fact, I've for the first time ever, I've seen house martins and birds kind of just completely fall out of the sky, hungry, cold, wet. So it's been incredibly unusual. And also the main thing that we've seen is far fewer butterflies and moths, because the flying conditions are just so awful. Oh. So we've kind of got the other problem there. So what I was going to say was, of course, like, this is another thing that insects are very good at. So my gut feeling this year here in the UK is like a massive amount of sadness that we're having such a bad insect year and it's affecting birds so much. But insects have endured changing, fluctuating seasons and temperatures for, you know, 400 million years. So insects rebound very, very, very quickly. So in other words, your situation that you've got is kind of the opposite, isn't it? You know, you've got absolutely loads of moths. My feeling is like, oh, wow, they'll be feeding a lot of birds at least. And your lizards over there will have plenty to eat. So that's really good. And then maybe next year might not be so favorable for them. So these kind of up-down cycles are, again, like you said, in an everyday way, this is partly, you know, to do with, you know, eggs as well. But if I could be so bold, Lynn, to, to, you know, for me, I know, I just feel like some of your listeners might be like, oh no, they're itching along with us and stuff like that. I think on a day-to-day level, the other thing about eggs that I remember and I think about all the time is that, you know, our lives take place in rhythms of birdsong. And in fact, you know, we have birds, you know, living. That's what really G's me up. That's what really makes me happy is when I see birds moving around in the garden and feeding and just being there, my sort of garden friends. But of course, you know, birds' song is really about eggs, you know. Birds can't afford to fly around with their eggs within them because obviously those eggs are very heavy. So by laying eggs, those eggs need to be sat on, incubated, protected. That requires male and female birds mostly to work together in pairs. If you live in a pair, you're going to have to defend a territory. You're going to have to evolve song. You're going to have to sing every day. You're going to have to really give off this kind of like communicative fire every single day. So in fact, you know, those moments of joy in the garden, I suppose, looking at birds, I'm like, well, this is an egg thing. You know, this wouldn't happen. We don't see the same pattern in mammals, for instance, without the eggs. We don't. Unfortunately, I wish we had more beautifully, you know, vocal mammals. But actually, many mammals are pretty silent most of the time. So again, the egg sort of influences our behaviours and our everyday circumstances in loads of different ways. Not all of them are like skin crawlingly disgusting.
Well, that's a more beautiful note to end this interview on. But before I let you go, I just have to know, Jules, what's the biggest egg that has ever been found?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the elephant bird is an extinct flightless bird that lived on Madagascar. It only went extinct, we think, about 1,000 years ago. So it was a species of bird that you know, interacted with local people in Madagascar for a long, long, long time. So their egg is, if you imagine an ostrich egg is something like 25 centimetres from, you know, at its tallest. So this is about 30, 35 centimetres. So you're getting to sort of basketball size. So there are still fragments of these eggs. They haven't even turned into fossils yet because this was such a relatively new species. So that's one. And the other contender for biggest egg is it's a mysterious fossil that turned up in Antarctica, 68 million year old fossil, and it looks like a deflated beach ball, and nobody knows what hatched from out of it. The best guess is it might have been some sort of seafaring lizard called a mosasaur, but the truth is we don't even know. So that's a beautiful mystery that we're waiting to kind of discover.
Oh, what a fascinating world. Well, the book is The Infinite Life, the story of eggs, evolution, and life on Earth. And Jules Howard has been my guest. He's a science writer and tells a very interesting story. You're a great storyteller. So Jules, thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you ever so much. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Lynn.